You're listening to the Addiction Medicine Podcast, the official podcast of the Governor's Institute. If this is your first time listening, thanks for joining us. The Addiction Medicine Podcast is designed for healthcare professionals and others interested in addiction medicine and will feature thoughtful conversations and insights from clinicians, patients, and families, policymakers, and other stakeholders. Remember to make us a favorite wherever you get your podcasts. You can also stay connected with us at governorsinstitute.org or follow any of our social media channels at @GovInst.
All right. So thank you for allowing us to talk about this today. And so some of what we've talked about has been referenced quite a bit already. And so we're going to fast forward through some of these. What I do want to reference is Dr. Navdas Gupta, who's been referenced in several of the talks earlier, who's doing the street drug analysis. So I am presenting on behalf of him today. So a portion of the talk is from him. And so our objectives, we'll talk about xylazine in the drug supply. We're going to talk about how xylazine might be impacting fentanyl intoxication and fentanyl withdrawal, and then kind of like where we are. So I'm going to give you the punchline, like we don't have the answers and we don't know. that's where we're going to conclude today. You know, we didn't have disclosure, sorry. So, you know, talking about xylazine, we've talked about this. It's an alpha-2 adrenergic agonist, not approved for human use. It's typically known as a horse tranquilizer. Importantly, from Dr. Des Gupta's work, it appeared in North Carolina in the spring of 2021. And those of us in the field working also recognized in the spring of 2021, we started having difficulty doing buprenorphine inductions. And this is whenever we started getting precipitated withdrawal with our normal induction protocols. And so, you know, initially we're thinking, and it may still be, that the fentanyl analogs were a big part of our problem, but beginning to understand that xylazine was introduced at the same time we started having these problems is making us think that xylazine may be our bigger issue here, not so much the fentanyl analogs. So, you know, this is work from Dr. Des Gupta, so I'm presenting on his behalf, so I'll do my best here. So just providing, we've seen this and we know this from our patients, press pills look just like regular pills and you can't tell the difference. And so he does have this drug checking lab. I'm going to go through this quickly now since this has been discussed. So this is his data as of August 2022. So his samples are not necessarily statewide. He gets samples from people who give him samples. So you just have to understand it's not necessarily a representative sample. So the way he gets the samples is, I think it's kind of cool. So people are asked, this mostly from syringe service programs, people are asked to bring their drug supply in some way. So they can bring cotton swabs, they can bring baggies that had drugs in it. So they don't have to be bringing their drugs. They can just bring things that touched their drugs. And then he has this kit. It looks like one of those, like a COVID test kit. So there's just a little vial and a swab. If it's a baggie, you just swab the baggie and put it in the little vial. If it's cotton, you just drop the cotton in the vial. And like, that's it. It is that simple. They put it in a bag and send it to the street lab. So up until now, this has primarily been done at syringe service programs, and he is really wanting to get this out to get, you know, better sample sizes. So he is really urging that we start asking our clinic patients to do this. This is all funded, so there's no charge to this. It takes a couple of days for a turnaround time. It's anonymous. Whenever a sample is given, you get a card with a barcode on it and a number, and then you go a couple days later, look on the website, and you scan your barcode or look up your barcode and your number, and that's how you find your sample. So he's asking that in clinics that we do this, opioid treatment programs that we do this. And so if anybody is interested, please reach out to him. He will send you kits and tell you how to get the kits back to him. So this is just generally what things look like, and this has been presented many times today. At this point, and he just texted me moments before coming up today, and he said, now there's more counties, with drug supply. So as of this week, Surrey County and Robeson County are not added on the list. So more and more counties are showing up positive for having xylazine in the drug supply. And it still seems to be around a quarter of the drug supply contains xylazine. So that the, and this was brought up earlier, but a little, I just wanted to emphasize this. So whenever he's getting these supplies and he's got people in front of them, he will ask questions about their experience. So he'll ask, what do you think is in the drugs? So that they can compare what the person thinks is in the drugs to what's actually in the drugs. But also their opinions about the drugs. And so from asking some of these things, people who have xylazine report that xylazine makes their drugs feel stronger. So that's what he's hearing. I think some of us in the field will hear patients say, it gives my fentanyl or gives my heroin legs. So you know, as referenced earlier, it just seems to make that fentanyl sensation last longer, which I think to some of us, maybe not Dr. McElligott, that's confusing. You're like, what in the world is going on? Is an alpha 2 receptor? Why is this interfering with our opioid receptor? So now we're going to go ahead and transition over to Dr. McElligott to talk about xylazine's impact on opioid intoxication and withdrawal.
Thank you all so much. I'm so excited to be here today and really just to speak to Robin for really leading this charge and being our North Star at UNC in her work in the addiction medicine game, I will say. I just wanted to highlight, this is my team. These are the people, I did the wrong thing again. I'm putting the wrong way. Point there. Okay. Oh dear. It's going backwards. No, the back isn't working. Okay. Those were the people who actually do the work. They are fantastic. And you can find them on my website if you're looking. So, where are they? Okay. I promise to get on the show here. My lab is a basic science research lab, so I do not, really ever engage with humans, as you can probably tell. But we use basic science in rodent models. We also do a little bit of non-human primate work, but that is not done at UNC, to look at how drugs change the brain and impact behavior. So I'm at the Bull Center for Alcohol Studies. And I started my work in opiates when I was a postdoc. So most of the work I'm going to talk to you about today is actually very old stuff. But we are carrying on this work now, and we're just getting started really looking at the xylazine question. So I wanted to have data for you today, but literally got xylazine on my animal protocol 2 weeks ago. So we don't have a whole lot yet, but stay tuned. Hopefully next year we'll have some work. But when I was a postdoc, I started trying to understand how opioids could engage the adrenergic system and the mechanisms by which they were doing so. And really what I found was that they were profoundly affecting the alpha 2 adrenergic receptor, which is what xylazine targets, as we've talked about today. So we use rodent models to investigate the intersection between opioids and the noradrenergic system in my lab. This is not to say that xylazine isn't affecting other parts of the brain, that opioids aren't affecting other parts of the brain, and that they're not interacting in other parts of the brain. But this is our starting point because it makes sense to us. So what are some questions that we really want to ask with this xylazine and opioid synergy and what's going on here? As we want to understand how different animals like opioids differently. Are they going to like xylazine combined with fentanyl? Are they going to register that differently? And we have a whole slew of behavioral techniques that we can use to get the animals to respond to us and tell us how they're considering their interoceptive qualities of these substances. And then really, do their adrenergic systems then respond differently to these drugs when they're used in combination? We have no clue right now. And so we can use this to probe how opioids, how xylazine, how any of the drugs that have been mentioned today are going to alter the brain to create lasting changes in this type of plasticity that which we think drives future behavior, drives future motivation to use drugs, drives future negative reinforcement to use drugs so they aren't feeling things like withdrawal and other subjects that we've talked on today. Okay, so I screwed up my slides here. But we are interested in the noradrenergic system because it's been long implicated in anxiety behavior and also in emotional learning. And the noradrenergic system, particularly the noradrenergic system in the medulla, is required for opioid-mediated reward behavior. So a lot of people talk about dopamine. You probably hear about dopamine all the time. But norepinephrine is actually really important for opioid mediated reward learning and things like that. And I can talk ad nauseum about that. So norepinephrine neurons themselves have both the alpha 2 receptor expressed all over them and the mu opioid receptor expressed all over them, and kappa 2, which I didn't really mention because I was trying to keep it simple. So both the alpha 2 and the mu opioid receptor are canonically coupled to GIO signaling pathways. Now, this is a whole bunch of, you know, mumbo jumbo, but what this means is that effectively there's the potential for them to do the same thing inside of neuron, right? But are they doing that? Again, we don't know. And a lot of that is going to depend on where they are expressed. So are they on your, Are they on your cell bodies? We think so. Are they on the terminals? We think so. But are they next to each other? Are they coupled to the same intracellular signaling pathways? And that'll really tell us if they're modulating one another in any ways. And we think that there's some evidence for this. And this evidence is really sort of things that I did when I was quite younger and had less gray hair. So we want to understand if these signaling systems are really going to interact, because we think that that might give us some clues as to what they're doing and why some people in particular might like trank or like xylazine while others do not. And so that's a topic that's been brought up a bunch. Okay, so we're going to investigate all of that business. So what did I do when I was much younger? I really wanted to look and measure norepinephrine in vivo, and I wanted to measure what was happening when animals were made physically dependent on opioids. So I used a technique called fast scan cyclic voltammetry to do this, which is, again, a bunch of mumbo jumbo, but it's a way that you can rapidly measure what is happening to norepinephrine on a subsequent time resolution in vivo in animals. And what I did was I was really interested in two different strains of rats. And I only used male rats because back then we didn't use females. Now we do, thank God. We used Sprague Dawley rats, which were kind of like our gen pop rat. It was a general sample. It's an inbred outbred line. They have a little bit more genetic diversity. And then I used a strain called Lewis rats. And these Lewis rats are super interesting for so many reasons. So I came from a stress field originally, and these guys are stressed out at baseline. They are a model that people use for PTSD. They also have anorectic behaviors and things like that. But when I started looking at their opioid behaviors, I didn't actually do this work. Other people did this work. They found that these rats existed at a level like they were already tolerant to opioids. If you put them in a self-administration box, they had an intra-dwelling catheter that was going to deliver opioids. What they found was that they would just press for opioids like they were already dependent. They didn't have to ramp up at all. So this was really interesting. So what I did was I made both my Lewis rats and my Sprague rats opiate dependent. So I could still do that. I have a really quick and dirty technique that I'm not going to belabor that does that. And it worked really well in both of these animals. And then I assessed their noradrenergic systems. But first I assessed their noradrenergic systems at baseline. And what I found was really interesting. So I gave them an alpha 2 antagonist challenge here. So it's a little bit inverted. But what I found was that the Sprague Dawleys were really well able to regulate their adrenergic system. They had really well functioning alpha 2 receptors, whereas the Lewis rats were less significantly able to regulate that system and figure out how it was working. So rats with a genetic propensity to consume opioids, these Lewis rats had dysregulated alpha 2 receptors at baseline. And then when I made them opioid dependent, I could push the Sprague Dawley rats to phenocopy, or sort of behaviorally, not really phenocopy, but behaviorally mimic what was going on with the Lewis rats. But I couldn't push the Lewis rats any further. They were already ceilinged out or bottomed out, or whichever way you want to look at it. So this showed that these general rats made physically dependent on opioids showed reduced alpha 2 receptor function, while rats that were genetic, had this genetic propensity to consume opioids could not. So we've gone on in my lab now to look, and I'm going to go through this really quickly, to look at the adrenergic neurons themselves and how this model of opioid dependence is going to modify the adrenergic receptors. And to make a long story short, it ramps them up. It ramps them up big time and through multiple different mechanisms that we're just starting to tease apart. So I'm not going to really belabor these points because it's a bunch of graphs that nobody but me and Cindy Kuhn, who I think is in the audience, is going to care about. But really, the big takeaway that I want you guys to have from this work is that opioid dependence results in a dysregulated noradrenergic system. Alpha 2 adrenergic receptors, which are the target of xylazine, may be critical mechanistic player in maintaining this heightened noradrenergic tone in the absence of drug. And this could promote learning. And this could promote this sort of reward-related behaviors. So moving on, we really want to do a lot of the work that has been hyped up today. I feel like I've had great hype people for me. I really appreciate it. We would love to know how xylazine is going to change opioid reward, how it's going to change opioid sensitization, how it's going to change opioid withdrawal. And we're hoping to really get these studies underway this summer. I've got some really excited grad students who are just chomping at the bit to get this done, to bring it back to horses. And so I really thank you guys all for your attention. And now I'm going to hand it back to Robin.
So we're coming back to like, so what? So what does this mean? And I know many of us have been talking about like, how is xylazine impacting opioid withdrawal? How is this impacting buprenorphine inductions? And that is how we have come to met. That's how we came to met with Dr. Desgupta. And then I realized, hey, we've got scientists here. Let's bring them into the discussion. And now we've got scientists who understand the alpha adrenergic system and understand the alpha 2 receptor. And then they were telling, you know, as Dr. Elegant was saying, telling us like, hey, wait, it is actually involved in opioid dependence and opioid withdrawal. So while we don't understand yet how xylazine is having this impact, we do think that there is a clinical basis for how xylazine is having this impact. And I think this is just super cool, like true translational work in the moment happening. And it's been awesome at this conference because she's like learning so much while we're here, like, oh, all these great targets to be thinking about. So what we're hoping to learn is, can this help us figure out how we can do buprenorphine inductions more efficiently? So that's our end goal here of how can we do this? So, you know, we've talked about the terrible wounds. We've also got a group with us working on understanding the underlying basis of xylazine with these wounds. The withdrawal state. So this is something I don't know has been talked a whole lot about, but for the clinicians, we understand, you know, things like the alpha 2 agonist and clonidine and that you have the rebound hypertension. And we have this as well with xylazine. And it wasn't until I heard someone say this, that it made so much sense to me. So our patients who are using xylazine are having xylazine withdrawal. So what we've been noticing is this just heightened intensity, just this anxiety is so high with people now. I mean, no one ever wanted to be in withdrawal. I mean, that's always been a thing, but now it's like so much worse. You know, people are just so terrified of withdrawal. And you see that very high anxiety, very high lability. And now we're understanding they're not just withdrawing from opioids, they're withdrawing from opioids and xylazine. And that's this lability that we're seeing. So now we're starting to see some vital sign instability when people are in withdrawal. And so now you can know when you're seeing this, like there's probably xylazine on board. We know with xylazine withdrawal, there's blood sugar dysregulation. We know there's some anemia dysregulation. So they are now, you know, they're not just coming to us in opioid withdrawal. They're now coming to us with these other physical symptoms that we're just not used to seeing. So now hopefully we can start to appreciate and understand like, yeah, there is actually more going on here. And one of the things that I just hear keep coming up is people saying, I found clonidine helpful. Again, this isn't evidence-based because we're all just learning, but it makes sense now how clonidine might be helpful. So as we're doing buprenorphine inductions, as we're precipitating withdrawal, using clonidine more regularly may be helpful because it may be something that's helping treat the xylazine withdrawal because buprenorphine's not going to treat the xylazine withdrawal. So clonidine just might be something a little more helpful. And then it was recommended to me from Dr. Desgupta. He said, hey, could you tell the docs, like, make sure your people are eating because there is this blood sugar dysregulation from xylazine withdrawal. So it may be helpful to let your patients know you might, may want to make sure that you're eating during this process that you're having this withdrawal. So what, oh, you know what? I missed a slide. There's one more, I think, most interesting point that we didn't get on here because this was maybe last week or so that Dr. Desgupta said, we were talking about we were talking about all the things that show up on the drug supply, the fentanyl and the xylazine, the methamphetamine. And he casually made this comment that the drugs either, the fentanyl either has methamphetamine or the fentanyl has xylazine. And I was like, whoa, stop. That is so incredibly interesting. So, you know, think about that for a second. You don't have both. Like the people are taking their fentanyl. They're either taking the fentanyl with methamphetamine. Well, they could be taking fentanyl alone, but they could be taking fentanyl with methamphetamine. But if methamphetamine is in their sample, xylazine is very likely not in their sample. He hasn't seen samples yet that have both. So what we don't know is who is going to have trouble with inductions. Like, we cannot predict that. And I'm not saying we can right now, but I'm just saying maybe we can. If methamphetamine is in their drug test, then xylazine is probably not in the drugs that they're using. So we can't know these things for sure, but just pointing out, sharing the knowledge that there may be some, because we don't have, as was mentioned, we don't have xylazine tests yet, but we may be able to start using other methods to figure out who may be having trouble with the buprenorphine inductions. So I think this was part for you.
Yeah. Thank you. Oh, could I have the clicker? Yeah. Thank you. So where are we going from here? Sort of with the animal models again. We really want to understand how these two substances are interacting on the noradrenergic neurons. We have a whole host of ways to look at this from both from the physiology standpoint, the biosensors and electrochemistry standpoint. And then we have a whole bunch of fun tools where we can knock out genes and look at things and see what's happening. But what does fentanyl and xylazine also do to the brain globally? So I'm narrowing in on a very small receptor population, but the functional connectivity that we can do with small animal fMRI can translate up to human clinical studies with fMRI. And we're very excited to couple this with behavior and photometry with Ian Shee, who runs our small animal fMRI core at UNC. And do that sort of work. And then really these other substances, I was so loving seeing all these lists. We just got dexmedetomidine on my protocol yesterday. So that's the next one on deck. And anything that you all want to look at, please contact me so that we can just be aware of things, because we're way behind the eight ball as compared to all of you all and what you guys are seeing in your patient populations. So now back to in summary.
Yeah. So just summarizing what we've talked about. So we talked about the evolution of the drug supply, this introduction of xylazine, and how that could be interacting directly with opioid intoxication, but also opioid withdrawal, and how mouse models are now going to be used like now to start to understand this relationship. So hopefully we'll start to get some answers very, very soon. And that's it. So please reach out to us with questions.